This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and podcast. Ireland was a cradle of Catholicism. Who shares the shame of the sexual abuse crisis that's crippled the church?
We put people up on a pedestal who proved unworthy of the pedestal, and we're annoyed at ourselves for doing it. Yeah. So there's huge anger at the abusers and the people who enabled abuse. But I think in Ireland there's a deep-seated anger towards having been the type of people who needed to put people up on pedestals who then abused the trust.
That's ahead on the show. The federal government's decision to halve the number of overseas arrivals into Australia may have satisfied those Labor premiers calling for the cut. But what are the ethical implications of tightening the borders, especially in a country where almost half the population are first or second generation migrants? The Sydney Policy Lab at Sydney University and the Ramsay Foundation have been working on a so-called roadmap to reopening. The lab's director is Professor Mark Steers. Mark, welcome. What are the ethical issues for you?
I think we always have to think about the primary ethics of government in the terms that Thomas Jefferson laid down all those years ago. So the job of government is to protect life, secure liberty, and ensure that people can pursue happiness, you know, make a good life for themselves. And at the moment, you know, Australia is doing a pretty decent job still of the first of those, you know, protecting the people's lives from the pandemic. But it's doing a pretty poor job, if I'm honest, on the second too, in protecting people's fundamental liberties and ensuring that they can make plans for themselves, create family life, travel when they need to travel, connect with the people that they need to connect with.
Don't the advocates for hard border closures and lockdowns also argue, though, that we're doing the ethical thing? I mean, saving lives, it's become the mantra, but I guess there's a lot in it.
Well, it's absolutely crucial to save lives. There's no doubt about that. And there's much to be proud of in Australia's pandemic response since COVID first hit us. But you always got to have your eyes on other ethical priorities too, and to make sure that you're doing things in a proportionate way and keeping the balance. The worry that I've got about where things have gone is that we've just turned away from some fairly fundamental rights, like the rights of an Australian citizen to return to their homeland having been away, in the blink of an eye, without almost any political debate or, you know, any arguments on shows like this. And that's a real problem, I think.
It seems to me the real complication is that it's very hard to humanely close borders when 25% of the population is first generation immigrant and another 25 or thereabouts have one or two parents overseas. We're talking here about people with very strong family connections beyond our borders, aren't we?
You know, every day now we hear awful stories of people being unable to reunite with parents before they pass away, or parents of newborns being separated by quarantine rules in Australian states. And these are, you know, sort of deep, humane tragedies in every case. And, you know, of course, there will always be ethical complications. There'll be difficult choices during a pandemic. The key, though, is we've got to hold things in balance, and we've got to hear those voices and weigh those interests and make sure that we're not just sort of closing our eyes to them and moving on, and, you know, always prioritising the apparently simplest response, which is to keep the borders slammed as closely shut as they possibly can be.
Part of the roadmap is to gradually open those borders, but you've cited, for example, executive power increasing at the expense of Parliament. You say it's worrying. Why?
I mean, I think throughout the pandemic, you know, one of the key pieces is that, you know, we've seen some fantastic efforts by non-governmental organisations, you know, amazing civil society efforts, charities on the ground helping people out. And we've also seen, you know, the best of government often, you know, great public health responses, amazing contact tracing stories which have kept people safe. But unfortunately, we've also seen big decisions taken behind closed doors without free and open debate, which is absolutely crucial to getting those decisions right and to making sure that everyone's voices are heard and all interests are weighed. And, you know, we've seen that especially, I think, in Australia in comparison to some other democratic countries. What's gone on in national cabinet when the state premiers have been arguing for the number of people entering the country to be cut? What deals have been cut? What arguments have been heard? And it's just vitally important that those issues be out in the open and the public be sort of actively participating in making them and weighing the issues and reaching a consensus decision.
You raise a fascinating point here, Mark. You are part of something called the Sydney Policy Lab, so expertise is clearly very important. But I wonder whether at times this notion of listening to the experts hasn't become almost absolute. An expert is going to give you the 100% solution, but often there's consequences to the 100% solution, isn't there?
And a good expert will recognise that, I think. That's always crucial, that you know, expertise is partial. You know, people spend years, decades, becoming experts in a particular issue and, you know, doing their research and talking to their peers, publishing their scientific papers. And it's absolutely right, we listen to their advice on those specific issues. But as you say, that's only a part of the picture. If you only prioritise one area of expertise or one area of an issue, then you're sort of taking your eye off some very, very fundamental human rights and other areas of human well-being, which also deserve our attention. I read an expert actually saying that in the newspaper earlier this week. She was saying, well, I'm an expert in epidemiology. I can tell you about infection and pandemic spread, but I can't tell you about mental health, and I can't tell you about economic well-being, and I can't tell you about family life. You know, you need other experts, but also other members of the public to be able to express their perspectives on those issues too. And the job of politics is to hold all of those complex issues in balance.
You have spoken critically about the Fortress Australia mentality. Australia's taken advantage of its geographic location, surrounded by water, relatively low population density to ensure very low fatality rates. So what's wrong then with the Fortress Australia mentality?
There are two real problems with Fortress Australia. I mean, the first is that it's led to a kind of complacency, which is, you're absolutely right, for a year the borders held pretty well and we were able to keep infection out of Australia, or at least to manageable levels, which meant that you could then have relatively short lockdowns, tracking and tracing systems, keeping COVID from having the devastating effect it's had elsewhere. But no border is impermeable, and the infection is always going to spread into the community once again. And we've seen that most recently with this Delta variant. I heard the Premier of New South Wales describe, you know, the Delta variant as a game changer. And people are saying, well, why couldn't we have kept it out? Well, you can't. We're a globally connected country. People are always going to come in and out, even when the borders are closed as firmly as they currently are. The infection will always find itself entering into the community. And the Fortress Australia mentality has meant that we weren't aware enough of that. So whilst other countries were getting vaccinated as rapidly and as effectively as they could, we were sitting here thinking, oh, well, with our closed borders, with our low community transmission, we'll be all right. We can take our time. It's not a race. One expert said that we shouldn't ever rush these things. It's dangerous to do so. Well, actually, we're in a global pandemic. We are part of the world. We need to vaccinate our population. And the Fortress Australia mentality meant that we haven't done it as effectively or as rapidly as we should have done. So that's the first issue. The second issue, though, is that it also has long-term consequences. Australia is a multicultural society. We are connected to the world. We're at our best when we learn from other countries, trade with them, connect with them in all kinds of social ways too. And it's just not all right to think that we can indefinitely step away from the global community and hope that we'll do well. We simply won't.
Yeah. What is the, what you call, psychological runway that we need to open up in the aftermath, or even, quite frankly, before the end of COVID, because the psychological runway forms a major part of your roadmap to reopening, which you have done with the Open Society Common Purpose Task Force.
The crucial issue is people need, I think, to intellectually, psychologically, as you say, re-engage with the world. They need, first of all, just to look what is happening to the pandemic elsewhere, to stop just looking at this issue through an Australian lens, to think about, okay, how is the US reopening? How has Israel so successfully reopened? What's happening in Northern Europe? And to learn lessons and be open to following the path of some countries that had a terrible start to the pandemic, but have regathered themselves and are, I think, sketching out a more sustainable path for the future. Vaccination is obviously crucial to that story. So the first part of the psychological runway is let's learn from the world again and not think that we are so special that we don't have anything to gain from that process. I think the second issue, though, is to say that, you know, it seems very likely, if you talk to the scientists across the world, that COVID is not going to go away anytime soon, that you're not going to be able to globally eliminate the virus, that you're going to have to be able to engage with it and live with it in some way. And again, you know, our politicians, I think, have been pretty slow to tell the Australian public that. We have our donut days and we celebrate pushing for zero. And here in Sydney, again, the Premier has recommitted to a lockdown in order to get those case numbers as close to zero as possible. That's fine for now, and it may be what we need to do, you know, before we have vaccinated. But at some point, when the border reopens, when we re-engage with the world, those case numbers will go up and we have to be ready for that.
Just finally, Mark, and more broadly, you're a political scientist and you would be aware of the theory that the welfare state, the social democratic state, tends to do better in, if you like, more isolationist, more closed societies. This is, I know, a theory. What has the pandemic revealed about this?
I think the pandemic has revealed that where people feel connected to their community, there's no doubt that they've been able to go above and beyond. So, you know, whether it be on your street or in your neighborhood or your town or your region, if you have strong bonds of solidarity and connection with the people around you, you've been able to do tremendous things. And there are amazing stories from right across the world of some extraordinary courage during the pandemic that we've seen as a result of those community attachments. So local community matters enormously. But at the same time, we've also learned that the world is interconnected. This is a global pandemic, a genuinely global phenomenon. We're at our best as a globe when we recognize that interconnection rather than pretend that it doesn't exist. And the only way we'll all get out of this is when the vaccines are spread properly and equitably across the world and whether the pandemic is in retreat everywhere. And so I think that that dual commitment, on the one hand, the power of the local, the power of community, the power of togetherness, and on the other hand, our utter interdependence globally, the interconnections between us as countries, those are the two lessons that we've learned. And we need to be able to combine those effectively if we're going to not only get through this pandemic, but as the saying goes, build back better in the future.
Professor Mark Steers, he's the director of the Sydney Policy Lab at the University of Sydney. He's also one of the authors of A Roadmap to Reopening, a report by the Open Society Common Purpose Task Force. Mark, thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you very much.
And a quick note and update on some news. Pope Francis is reportedly up and walking after surgery for a painful intestinal condition. He's 84. He's been soldiering on despite the pain for a while, so the success of the surgery is good news. And you're with Andrew West. If you were asked to name the most Catholic country in the world not so long ago, you might have said Ireland. Around 20% of Australians trace their heritage to Ireland, and its historic association with Catholicism is powerful. But since revelations of widespread sexual abuse in the Irish Church emerged in the 90s, observant Catholics have become a small minority. Irish writer Derek Scally is the author of the new book, The Best Catholics in the World, The Irish, the Church, and the End of a Special Relationship. He joined me from his home in Berlin.
What's interesting is where it used to be, where it rose to, and where it is now. So before the pandemic, we were talking around 15 to 20% weekly mass attendance. Back in the good old days, as they would call it, I was born in 1977. So when I was a child and I was an altar boy, we're talking well over 90%. I'd say in rural Ireland, near to 100%, but with urban areas slightly more liberal, we're talking early 90s. But before the modern revolution of Irish Catholicism in 1850, back before in the early 19th century, mass attendance was about 20%. So we seem to have seen this massive spike up to near 100% of mass attendance, and then a really sharp decline back down. So there's a case to be made that Ireland hasn't lost its faith. It's just lost the recent iteration of Catholicism, of which there are many, and perhaps we may be entering into something new.
Yeah, the biggest and most obvious reason for the collapse of Catholic devotion is the sexual abuse crisis, perhaps more severe than anywhere else, including Australia, frankly, where it's been terrible. But is it the only reason, Derek? I mean, there've got to be some other cultural factors, haven't there?
Indeed. I mean, I don't need to tell listeners in Australia the damaging effect of both the sexual abuse on the survivors and their immediate families, but also the clerical cover-up. And that seems to have been the defining characteristic for most people, where they said, right, somebody who's a paedophile, as much as I struggle with it, they are a person who needs assistance. They need to be taken out of the priesthood and given treatment and kept away from children. But the people who enabled them, now there's the real problem. And that is where things collapsed in Ireland. And that's where people realized they were dealing with people, they were dealing with institutions, they were dealing with power. So you had this collapse on the one hand, and on the other hand, you had in Ireland in the 90s a tremendous surge of prosperity. You saw EU funding really beginning to blossom on the landscape, and you saw education. I mean, I'm part of a generation who had free university education from the mid-90s, and a few decades before in the 60s, free secondary education. So you're slowly seeing, effectively, the Irish people being educated past the level of education of their priests. There was a time when the priest and the doctor and the lawyer and the solicitor would have been sort of the educated people in the classic rural Irish parish. But suddenly you had all these people who were far more educated. But Irish religious education and instruction really didn't keep pace. We had Irish Catholic run schools. Most of the schools were run by the Catholic Church, but they were somewhat not able to adapt to this new educated, prosperous reality. So it collapsed for all those reasons.
It's also, I'm sure, got to have something to do with both the flight and then return of a lot of Irish. I mean, as you say, in the 1990s, you had this return of an Irish diaspora, which had experienced something outside of a very cloistered Catholic world. How significant was that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the history of Irish history without immigration and emigration in and out is really unthinkable. And the prosperity that was coming in, it was companies, it was American multinationals largely, who, you know, had people like in Australia of immigrant stock, and they would be brought in to work for the large computer companies, the pharma companies. So, yeah, they were bringing in a breath of fresh air. I mean, that's what's always been. On the one hand, the emigrants who leave Ireland, they often are like the liberal, energetic ones who could change society. And the tragedy is often that they leave and they take the pressure out of the pressure cooker, and the more conservative Ireland remains. But if you flip that, if they do return, they are more free radicals. And I think we saw another wave of that in the 2000s, which, you know, really catalyzed change and modernity. So by the time Pope Francis came in 2018, I write in the book, we didn't have holy water, we had flat white coffees, and we didn't have Holy Communion, we had sourdough bread. So yes, we very much, they brought the world in a way that the Catholic Church really hadn't done, except right back at the early days in the 600s, when, you know, Catholicism was bringing the world in of education, of science, and so on. Something people forget, before it used to be an accelerator, and now it just turned into something regressive, something defensive, something effectively that had to go.
Derek, just how Catholic was Ireland until the 1990s? I mean, how pervasive was the church's, not just influence, because there's a lot of places where there's religious influence. What power did the state give the church?
I think it's fair to say the Irish Catholic Church as an institution always had as much power as the people gave it. And that is the most painful thing for people to realize in Ireland. But it's a point I gently keep making over and over and over again. And the second point is the Catholic Church as an institution was made up of people who were Irish passport holders. Now, that may seem obvious to listeners in Australia, but if you follow the debates in Ireland, you'll see a psychological trick known as othering, which is, you know, we can call it scapegoating or othering. And in my lifetime, we've gone from the Catholic Church, our priests, you know, our holy anointed or our spiritual warriors, missionaries going out to Africa and so on. It was very much ours. And then as the abuse and the other scandals emerged, we flipped it. The narrative, the public narrative flipped to them. It was very much they did terrible things to us. And I'm gently suggesting that while this reaction is completely understandable, it was always about us and the power. We gave ourselves as a Catholic Church privilege and we put these people up onto a pedestal, the bishops and later cardinals. But there's always a psychological need. And during the Pope's visit, I met a nun. She said, "We seem to be dealing with a really old anger." And I said, "What anger do you mean?" And she said, "We put people up on a pedestal who proved unworthy of the pedestal and were anointed ourselves for doing it." Yeah. So there's huge anger at the abusers and the people who enabled abuse. But I think in Ireland, there's a deep-seated anger towards having been the type of people who needed to put people up on pedestals who then abused the trust.
Yeah. And you point out, Derek, that it was not uncommon to have photographs of leading Irish politicians right up to the 1980s, actually, kissing the hand of bishops.
This was quite a common practice everywhere in the world, so it's not that unusual. From our current perspective, it just seems ludicrous, but deference was expected and deference was given. And that is the really complicated transaction, the really complicated atmosphere for somebody of my generation to accept that deference was expected and deference was given. And one of the abuse reports, I asked the author, "What for you was the most crucial part of the report?" And she said, "Undue deference."
Now, I said I'd return to that very symbolic moment, 1979. Pope John Paul II visits Ireland in the very first year of his papacy, I think. This was surely a moment of the greatest triumph for the Catholic Church in Ireland. Why do you, fascinatingly, Derek, see this as the beginning of the end for the Catholic Church?
Because I put myself in the shoes of a priest looking or a bishop looking out over the crowds. We had a mass with 1 million people in a time when Ireland had a population of 3.5-4 million. So 1 million people at a mass. If I was a priest and I looked out at that crowd cheering, I would have said, "I can do anything I want in this country." And sadly, people took that. And again, my book is really not having a go at the Catholic Church. It's putting it in the context and expressing great sorrow at everything that went wrong because of the beauty of the message got so perverted. But really, with the high point of the perversion, I'd say, was this mass, because the power was absolute. They literally sealed the deal. And it was from then on that you really start to see the terrible abuses happening. When Pope John Paul celebrated mass, there was a warm-up act, and of the three priests, two of them were already fathers. Again, people were quite understanding towards them afterwards when this came out, but the hypocrisy didn't escape them. The people who had father children were some of the better ones. So the Pope John Paul mass was basically, the Catholic Church felt from this point on we're untouchable, and it was the feeling of untouchable that actually caused many of the problems rather than the actual abuses themselves.
Yeah, you referred there, I think, to a bishop, a very popular bishop of Galway, who didn't get involved in any child abuse, but it was later revealed that he had a girlfriend and had fathered a child.
Indeed, and Father Michael Cleary, the other, was another very, very popular priest. They were all very popular, and the tragedy was these priests were very close to the people. They had huge charisma, and they were very much of the people. And this is, again, the narrative. It was effectively the Pope's visit was, you know, Christ's anointed coming to Ireland to tell us everything was okay. That was the level of emotional need at the time. I'm just trying to put the Irish Catholic narrative back into making it life-size again and just suggest that what we've experienced and the tremendous rise and fall was a historical period. It needed to fall, it needed to go, and maybe, just maybe, once it's been cleared, there's room for spiritual growth and personal religious belief, because at the moment, the atmosphere is so toxic that in 2018, when people went to the papal mass, they were afraid to tell their neighbours. So we've gone from 1 million people going to see the Pope to people afraid to admit that they've gone to see his successor.
This is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West with you. We're speaking today with Derek Scally, the author of the new book, The Best Catholics in the World, The Irish, the Church, and the End of a Special Relationship. In the time that we've got left, First of all, explain to me the significance of the figure 1 in 4.
1 in 4 is the number that emerged from a survey, not just of people with a religious background, but the Irish population. And I was asking, have you been exposed to physical or sexual abuse? When you added up all of the various groups, men and women, various age groups, between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 people in Ireland has experienced some form of abuse. It is a staggering number. It is one that most people in Ireland still fail to grasp or refuse to grasp. But it is also the name of an organization that was set up to bring this, to lobby for these people, to make this public. It is a place where people can seek counselling. It's publicly funded, but the tragedy is there's so many people seeking counselling that often they have to close the waiting list for counselling. And I think it's testimony to just the sheer violence and trauma of Ireland's past in the church and beyond the church, that there is just such an abuse legacy that we struggle to imagine. And the great tragedy, and I point out in the book, is that this abuse is continuing. It's just no longer happening in the church context. There are no children there, and there's child safety provisions, world-class provisions, but no children. It's families and it's other institutions. And it will be interesting to see how what energy people have in shattering the taboo of abuse in the family.
Tell us also about the 10,000 women and girls who between, I think, 1922, and this really shocked me, 1996, who worked in the so-called Magdalen laundries. What was their fate? How did these girls end up in these places, and what was their fate?
These were young women whose fate, either getting pregnant or in some cases being considered too sexy, they challenged and they questioned and they were a provocation to the idealized version of Ireland that Ireland had for itself as a modest Catholic plain nation. And having an unmarried mother or having a young girl who's pregnant and no husband, you had to make that disappear, hide things. And these women were hidden. The men never had any comeuppance. The men were protected, but the women had to go. And these women were put away in institutions, often collusion between their families and the priests. And they were not collected, and they were effectively slaves for decades. Some say they got good treatment, others got terrible treatment. And that legacy is continuing to this day. The state is apologizing. I attended a reception at the president's house in Dublin, where they were told, this is our shame, this is not your shame. So that's a tremendous help for these women, that there's still many of them alive. And it is our shame as a nation.
This brings us to a very powerful conclusion, and one that I think really registered with me. You now live in Germany. You make an extraordinarily persuasive parallel between Ireland of the 20th century largely and Germany after World War II, East Germany in particular, under the Stasi. What is the biggest parallel there?
I think the biggest parallel is Ireland is a country that is struggling to accept responsibility for its past. We would like to find somebody we can dump not only the blame and the legal guilt, but also responsibility. Germany is a country which has its terrible past, and as you point out, comparisons really are inappropriate entirely, and I don't make them in the book, but I think the legacy of the Nazi era was so vast that once they got going, they really created a German institutions and also a sense of responsibility for, you know, being German. One of the terms and conditions is you need to understand what happened, not because you're personally to blame, but you need to understand the circumstances and what was possible. This style of institution, this style of thinking has been applied to the East German past, much more recent, 30 years ago it fell, again, accepting that this is a collective past and this only happens in a society where the society passively or actively allows it to happen. And I suggest in the book that we don't really see anything similar in Ireland yet, because we're still trying to find somebody else to pin it on. But as a society, you have to accept the good and bad of the history of your society. You cannot just cherry pick the flattering parts. And with institutions and historians and process, this is possible. If not, we just end up in a permanent Punch and Judy show.
But there's some real similarities between Catholic Ireland of the 20th century and communist era East Germany. For example, in East Germany, the children of people considered not sufficiently loyal were removed from their parents. I guess in the way that children were taken from single mothers in Ireland. If you didn't have the requisite loyalty to the state or the church, that made you a suspect figure.
Yes, in some respects, some people might be horrified to think I'm comparing Catholicism and communism, but I'm comparing closed systems, and East Germany was very much a closed system, and Ireland was a closed system. There was a small group of people at the top who believed they knew best, and they knew how to use their power, exploit people for that. So I make several comparisons, but at the end of the day, it isn't really what was at the time, it's how you deal with it at the present. I'll give you an example. The head of the body that deals with these Stasi files, secret police files, he said he meets so many people in his work, and one woman said to him recently, I was responsible, she said, for forced adoptions. So people who were, let's say, opposed to the regime, their children could be taken from them. And this woman was responsible for finding them new homes with true party believers. And she told this guy, who's now the head of the custodian of these Stasi files, she said, I believed I was doing the right thing at the time. I was convinced I was doing the right thing at the time. But now I realize the damage I was doing. And it is now my task to try and reconcile my huge ambivalence towards my past with what I know now. And I think many people in Ireland believed that this was the best. They believed these educated priests and nuns, and the anger now, weren't we very foolish to believe them, is what a woman in my old parish told me. But there was a need to accept it, and that is very complex. And the simplest way is to blame them, point the finger and bury them, lock them away the way we used to lock up single mothers. But religious cannot be locked away, and I decided to talk to them before this whole generation will eventually die. The religious are disappearing, and I want to talk to them and talk to them about Catholic Ireland before it disappears over the horizon.
That's Derek Scally, author of The Best Catholics in the World, The Irish, The Church, and The End of a Special Relationship. There's a longer version of that interview at our homepage. And you can follow us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Muta Tadias and Hamish Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.